Paragimel Avos, Mishnah Yitzayin, the very end of the Mishnah, talks about Siyog L'Chachma Shtika, that the fence for Chachma Shtika. And remember, Rabbi Kiva is giving a list of things here. Meiser is Siyog for Oyesha, for wealth. Mesiris is a Siyog for Torah. Nedarim is a Siyog for Prishos. It should have said Shtika Siyog L'Chachma. In all these examples, it's saying what you're supposed to do to create a fence to protect what comes next. So, Meiser is a siyog for wealth. It preserves your wealth. It brings wealth. It's defense for wealth. Mesira is the siyog for Torah. Making the darim to prohibit those things that are otherwise permitted is the barrier or the fence to hold in precious if you want to stay away from things. So, shouldn't it have said, Shtika is the siyog for Chachma? So, why is it saying, Siyog l'Chachma, Shtika? The fence for Chachma is Shtika, is silence. So, in the Perish on Avos, Mechacham Avad Yosef, Chacham Avoch, he brings that maybe the reason why this is reversed is because all the other examples were things that you do. You set aside Meiser, you give Meiser, and that's the siyog for Oysher. The Mesiris, being careful with the Mesiris, is the Siyag for Torah. Making a Neder is the Siyag for Precious. But you don't do anything when you're quiet. It's not like you're actively, you're being passive. So therefore, maybe that's the reverse. Siyag L'Chachma is Shtika. Now, the concept of Siyag L'Chachma Shtika, Rabbeinu Yonah explains, is twofold. This is a Siyag, he says, whether it's for the midos of Chachma or for Chachma itself. And he explains, the midos of it is essentially not interrupting somebody. If someone is talking, you're going to observe shtika, means you're not going to interrupt someone who is speaking. If you didn't hear about something, you're not going to speak and say you heard about it or talk about it. So, these are midos that a person should conduct himself. So, in that way, shtika, the idea of being silent, is just proper conduct, that you're going to pay attention to someone without interrupting, you're going to not interject things that you don't know what you're talking about, if you don't know, you don't know. And then when it comes to chachma, so the Rabbeinu Yonah says, it means someone who's greater than you in chachma, you're not going to speak, you're not going to say anything because you want to learn from him. You have what to learn. You're going to watch him and pay attention to him. And if you're going to be busy saying what you have to say, you may not get an opportunity to hear what he has to say. And that's what's important to you. So when the Talmud is in front of the Rebbe or in front of someone who's greater than him in Chachma and you're silent, it's a siyag l'chachma. That's how you're going to learn. If you pay attention to people around you without saying what you have to say, just listen to what they have to say, that's a tremendous yog for Chachma. So, the Tana of Rekiva is telling us that there's great value in remaining silent. Part of me says great value in biting your tongue. Now, he doesn't get into the times when you're ready to say something and afterwards you're very glad you did not. Or if you did say something, I'm sure you may have had experience when you're very sorry that you said anything at all. Sometimes, this is a judgment call. We see a situation, we make a judgment of what's going on, and then we can choose to speak up or not. And if we misjudged, then our words would have been really bad. So if you withhold the judgment and don't say what you want to say, very often you're very glad about it afterwards. Now, that may be not be chachma. You know, it's siyag l'chachma shtika, the idea that the person who is silent, that's the defense for chachma, maybe in this context it just doesn't show everyone else how poorly you are thinking. Whereas no one can think someone else is stupid if they don't hear what they have to say. It's only when you say things that are stupid, people are like, oh, this person is what he's talking about. But even without that, I'm just thinking of times, there are many times when you're better off not saying anything than saying something. And I always think of this concept of siyag l'chochma shtika. You know, again, in the literal context of the Mishnah, Rabbi Akiva is saying, by remaining silent, you will learn and you become wise. And many times, the wise thing is to be silent. And maybe that's another way of reversing the order. That instead of saying shtika siyag l'chochma, sometimes the smart thing is not to say anything. I'll give you an example. I'll give you a great example, and I'm sure there are more. But this one is kind of painless, so I'll give you this example. There's a teacher I know in Baltimore who always is a high-energy person, and she would always be involved in national projects and different things to keep her class interested, and very creative person, and very boisterous, and the kids generally have a very good rapport with this teacher. I think for years she taught in the girls' school, then she taught in the boys' school. Anyways, when the space program was determined to send a teacher to space, teachers applied from all over the country to be the teacher to go on the Challenger. And she also applied. She's going to apply. And she did. She sent an application, and she writes an essay why they should pick her. And she went to Rabbi Chaim Shlita, what are the halachas if I'm going to be in space? And she's doing this with her students. She's explaining to her students stage by stage of her application process and what she has to do and why she should be, and the halachas of being in space. And she makes a whole big deal out of this. And of course, she wasn't picked to be in the space program. And time goes by, and a year later, the Challenger is launched, and we all know the Challenger exploded, and there were no survivors. The day after, a boy in school walks over to this lady and says, "Mrs. So-and-so, I wish you were on the Challenger." And she was so shocked by this little boy's comment, she's ready to throttle him, figuratively. And she doesn't say a word. She says, "Moishi, why do you say that?" And Moishi says, "If you are on the Challenger, you're such a tzaddikus, Hashem would never have let it blow up." And she realized, what would have happened had she said what was on her mind to say a minute before? So sometimes the smartest thing is just don't say anything, because you're misjudging, misreading what you just saw or what you just heard. Any question?
No.
Yeah. So that's a great story. Like I said, it's like a painless story. There are a lot of painful stories where people have said things to other people that they never should have said. One of the classics, I hope it never happened, but you know, you never ever approach a woman and ask her, "Oh, you're pregnant, when are you due?" She might not be pregnant. That's happened. You have to be careful what you say. And you have to use your head. And that always, someone said to me, the one who received these kind of comments, you ask, what were they thinking? And the answer is, they weren't thinking. It's not shot, they just weren't thinking. People say thoughtless things, and they can be very hurtful. And sometimes, the minute it went out of your mouth, you realize you should never have said that. So, there's nothing like shtika. And again, the Mishnah says elsewhere, Lo matzasi tov l'guf el mishtika. There's nothing better than shtika. Shtika is something that is undervalued, I should say. We don't value silence enough. In life, generally, you're much better off. The Gemara even has a saying. The Gemara says, for a good, like a proverb, a good saying will give you a dollar. For being quiet, you get $2. Silence is more valuable than the good saying or the good proverb. There's a value to just being quiet and think what you're thinking, don't say it. In life, usually it will do you well. There are times you have to speak up. There are times you have to speak up. But I think you should really think twice before. Is this one of those times? This is true of almost anything. It could be true at work. It could be true in marriage. It could be true on a date. It could be true in any exchange. More often than not, we're better off not saying than saying. Now again, as far as the specifics of this Mishnah, Sieg L'Chach Mashtika, there's no question. If you want to learn, you got to be quiet. Because if you're busy saying what you have to say, then you're not going to hear what the person you want to learn from has to say. So that's a concept as well that we have to understand. If you want to grow in Chachma, you have to learn how to hold on to what you have to say. And sometimes you should write it down. Sometimes you have a good thought, you have a good question, a good proof to what has been said. So you can write it down, but keep listening, because once there's an interruption, there'll be another and another, and you'll miss out from what this person ultimately wants to convey, wants to say over. I think that's all included in what Rabbi Akiva is trying to say. But again, as far as the bigger picture, most of the time it's wise not to say. If you have a suffix to say or not to say, always err on the side of silence. It's always going to be better. Not to be misunderstood, I just want to make one total digression. That doesn't mean you go on a date and two of you decide to look at each other for 2 hours. You're not going to say anything because Siyag L'Chach Mashtika and Domo says a good Tov Mashtika, so we'll just be quiet the whole time. And obviously, I don't mean that. If the point is to have a conversation, then obviously you have a conversation. I'm just saying it's more thing in the context of judgment calls, making decisions and saying things based on that, and your decisions may be flawed, like the two cases I just said before, whether it was with the teacher, whether with the woman who was heavy, whatever it is, you're making judgments, and then you're speaking based on your judgments. Who says your judgments are accurate? So you're always better off just not saying. Okay, let's move on to the next Mishnah. Hu haya omer, Rabbi Akiva would say, Mishnah Yilches, Chaviv Adam Sheniv B'Tzelem. Man is dear that he was created in the image. And this is a special an endearment that he is made aware of it. Like it says, "Ki b'tzelem l'kim asas ha'adam." The Bereshit created man in his tzelem. The Mishnah continues. We'll stop at this point. We all know the Bereshit has no physical attributes. There's nothing physical about the Bereshit. Even when the Chumash talks about terms like hands and af and ayin and different body parts, we know this is all just a sabre so'ezen, and it is not meant to be understood literally. We don't learn that way. There were some Yishonim who did. We do not learn like that. The Yibar Hashem has nothing physical. There's nothing physical about the Yibar Hashem. And I should add, there's nothing spiritual about the Yibar Hashem. And I may have mentioned to you in the past, the Ibn Hashem is neither physical nor spiritual. The Ibn Hashem created all physical things, the entire universe, to the extent that we understand it, to its furthest reaches in space, to the depths of the ocean, to the smallest things under the microscope. Higgs boson, that's the smallest particle now. So whatever it is, the Ibn Hashem created all physical things. The Ibn Hashem created all spiritual things. We think of Gan Eden, Gehenim, angels, Malachim, Sofim, Afanim, Chayos, HaKodesh, Kisei HaKavod. All these things are also creations of the Ibn Hashem. The Ibn Hashem is neither physical nor spiritual. The Ibn Hashem created all things physical, created all things spiritual. In the Animamins, one of the 13 Animamins is the Ibn Hashem is not physical. Ein Adumas HaGuf, Ein HaGuf. There's nothing physical about the Ibn Hashem. So I asked Rashi Yisrael of Rav Weinberg, so why doesn't it say in the Animamin the Ribbono Shel Olam is not physical or spiritual? Why does it only say in the Animamins that the Ribbono Shel Olam is not physical? Again, the Animamins are based on the Rambam's Perash HaMishnah, where it describes that these are 13 things that are necessary in Emunah, or else if you're missing one of these 13, you cannot have a relationship with the Kodesh Baruch. You cannot relate to Hashem if you are lacking in these 13 Emunahs. So I asked Rav Shiva, so good, so if Hashem is neither physical nor spiritual, if Hashem created all things physical and spiritual, shouldn't that be in the Animam? The Ibn Hashem is neither physical nor spiritual. So he said to me a very important yisoid, very important principle. He said like this: the Animamins are not a list of 13 truths. There are many truths. The Animamin is a list of 13 that if you're missing one of these, you're not bikaris. A person who's missing one of these cannot relate to Hashem. The other truths, if you make a mistake, you can still relate to Hashem. You're in error, but you can still have a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If a human being thinks the Ribbono Shel Olam is physical, he cannot have a relationship with Hashem. Once Hashem is physical, I can hide from him, he can't find me, I can do what I want, he doesn't know what I'm doing. You cannot attribute a physical entity to Ribbono Shel Olam. And if a person does, that's not bikkurisus. You also can't attribute spirituality to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But if a person does, by mistake, he's in error. So he's making a mistake. It's an error. It's false. But he could still have a relationship with Kodesh Baruch Hu. If in his mind the Ribbono Shel Olam is spiritual, he could still understand that I have to do what I have to do, and the Ribbono Shel Olam watches me, knows what I'm doing, and I mice count. All the things that are necessary to have a relationship with Kodesh Baruch Hu will exist, even if I am in error. So the one mistake to think Hashem is physical is apikarsis. The other mistake to think Hashem is spiritual is a toast. It's a mistake. It's an error. Doesn't make him into an apikarsis. So the Animam is not a list of things that you have to know as true. It's a list of the 13 truths that are essential to being a Yid as opposed to being an apikarsis. So the Ribbono Shel Olam is neither physical nor spiritual. So what does it mean the Ribbono Shel Olam created Adam Betzalem? So it's an expression we use. And Rabbeinu Yonah points it out. Obviously it's not meant to be literal. In some way, there's a comparison between man and the Ribbono Shel Olam. And I believe the way the Nefesh HaChaim puts it, it goes to the point of Bechira. That in one way, man is similar to the Ribbono Shel Olam, that man has Bechira. And the Ribbono Shel Olam obviously has Bechira. The Ribbono Shel Olam chooses, and we choose. In that way, we are similar. And the term Tselem really is meant to indicate a similarity. When we use the word in our talk of Tselem, we often talk about an idol as a Tselem. An idol is a representation of a force or power in the universe. And it's not to say that these are not forces. They are forces. They're real forces. These forces are controlled by Kadosh Baruch Hu. And the people who worship these forces forget that there's Ribbono Shel Olam who guides and created these powers. So there are people who worship the ocean, people who worship the sun, people who worship the moon. These are real things. They do things. There's power in them. The sun gives light and photosynthesis. There's things there. They make a representation of that power, whether it's going to be Neptune representing the sea or something else representing the sun. I think Ra by each, whatever it is, they make representations. That's a Tselem. A Tselem is something that represents another thing. So Adam was Niver B'Tselem. We have something about us similar to the Ribbono Shel Olam that we call the Tselem and Tselem Elokim. And again, Rechaim says it's the uniqueness of Bechira, that we have the ability to choose. There have been many studies with various animals and looking into the intelligence of chimpanzees, the intelligence of dolphins, and the way I understand the articles I have seen, they can be taught certain things, but they can't think. They can't take information and start putting things together and come with conclusions. They can be trained, they can be taught, but they'll never think the way we understand the idea of a thought process. This is a uniquely human thing. And the ability to decide, Bechira, is a human trait. And it doesn't exist by Malachim either. And this is something you may have seen in Sfarim that say differently, and I'm aware of where it comes. I think it all comes from the base Medrash or base Talmud of Kelm and all the Bali Musa who came from Kelm, and it keeps spreading. And many Sfarim are very, very strongly, very vocal that is totally in error and it's not right and it's wrong. I don't know how many different ways you could say wrong, but in many ways you could come up with, that's what they say. And to the point that if angels would have Bechira, then that's tantamount to Avodah Zarah in itself. That to think that they have a choice. Angels have no choice. Angels have a mission, they're instructed what to do, and they do their job. You will find cases in Chumash where there are Malachim who seemingly had Bechira, and every time you find it, it's when the angel is in human form. When an angel is in human form, he will have Bechira. But as soon as he does not have human form anymore, he will not have Bechira. An angel in angel form, there's no Bechira by an angel. The angel is a soda machine. You put in your coins, you press the button, out comes the pop. There's no thinking. It's set up, this is how it works. And that's how it is in the world of Malach. And again, if you find references different, there's always going to be an explanation. And again, I know that there's a different taich that you may have come across, a different svarim, and I would wager it's always coming from back to Kelm, and the Talmidim, and the Talmidim, Talmidim from there. So this is a unique chaviv onshin b'tzam. Adam is chaviv, he has this. And chiba yisera, kibitzela kin asas adam. So the way it's explained in the Mishnayis is that it's one thing to give someone a gift. It's a much bigger thing to let him know that he received a gift. So the chiba yisera, the extra endearment, is making Adam aware that he has this gift. If you give something to someone and they don't know that it's from you, so right, they have it, you didn't accomplish much as far as creating a relationship because they don't know it's from you. In fact, the Gemara says a line that if someone gives someone a gift and doesn't let them know from whom the gift is, it's kilu zarek evan makir. It's as if you threw a stone at avodah zarah. It's like you did avodah zarah, because avodah zarah is useless. It's wasted energy. Nothing accomplished by doing avodah zarah. So too, giving a gift and the person doesn't know who gave the gift, so then you wasted an opportunity to create achva, reyus, and so on. In this context, the way it's explained in the Mishnah, if the Baruch Hashem had given us this gift and not told us it was a gift, we wouldn't appreciate perhaps what this was when Hashem gave us. So the pasuk makes a point. This is something very special that we have. And because we have it, we shouldn't abuse it. Like any gift the Baruch Hashem gives us, we have to use very carefully. I know that there is a question that lingers behind the back burners of our minds. What is the gift of Bechira? And what does it mean that man has free choice if deep down we know the Ibn Hashem is aware of everything we do before we do it, or everything we will do? So doesn't that mean you don't really have a choice? And there are all kinds of answers to this question. They all basically boil down to the same thing. You know, if an adult goes to a child and says, "Do you want a lollipop?" And the child says, "Yes," and they give him the lollipop, you knew before you offered the lollipop that they're going to want the lollipop when you give the lollipop, right? So another much less saw is a chess master. You want to play against a chess master. If you're familiar with the game of chess, a lot of it has to do with predicting moves. And the chess master knows exactly how the game is going to end. You could do any one of five different things that make no difference. He's going to win the game by countering. They have all the moves calculated ahead in his mind. You do this, I do this, you do this. I don't know if you realize, or ever watched them, that's exactly what's going on in their heads. Some people actually say it out. You do that, I'll do this, do this, do that. And it's all predicting what you'll do, what I'll do, what you'll respond, until the outcome. And if a person is a master, it's all a foregone conclusion from the beginning how it's going to end. So, did you have a choice? Yeah, you had a choice. But he was manipulating the choices. So, these are the mishalim that are given to explain Yediya and Bechira. But I'm really most comfortable with the Rambam, and the Rambam writes in Hilchos Teshuva that don't bother trying to figure it out. It's beyond our ability to grasp. That's what the Rambam says. Forget about it. Don't even worry about it, because you won't figure it out. That's what the Rambam says. The Ravid is upset. How can you say such a thing? But the Rambam is very clear. We don't get it. We don't get it, so we're not going to get it. So I don't have to come up with a marshal to explain it, because ultimately all my mashal will give you will have a flaw. The bottom line is, we have Bechira. And the Rosham knows. And how do you reconcile it? I can't. Fine. And I'm fine with that. The Ram says, you can't. Let's go on with life now. Now that you can't reconcile, we'll go on. So we have Bechira, and it's uniqueness that man has. And if we use our Bechira for the right things, then we will be rewarded. We'll get schar for choosing the right things. If we use our bechira poorly, then we will be punished for our choices. And really, this all leads into the next Mishnah. The very next Mishnah, depends how the Mishnahs are broken up, but the way it's broken up most Mishnahs, the next Mishnah is Hakol Tzafoi Versus Nesuna. Hashem sees everything, but you have permission to do what you want. That's exactly the words of the Mishnah are. Hakol Tzafoi. Hashem is aware, he knows exactly. Rishus Nesuna, you can still choose what you want, despite the fact, Hakol Tzafoi. So, can you reconcile it in your head or not? The Rambam says, don't even bother, you can't reconcile it.
Did we say that Goyim and Jews have the same Rabbah
Bechira? Ah, great, that's where we go. Excellent question. The Mishnah, as it reads, Chaviv Adam, Shnei B'Tselem, Chibi Yisrael Ne'odah Aslo, Tselem L'Kim HaSasa Adam, does not differentiate between Jew and non-Jew. The continuation of the Mishnah, Chaviv and Yisrael, Sheniku Barim L'Mokom, Klai Yisrael is special, we're Hashem's children. The wording of the Mishnah lends itself to say that there's no difference between Jew and non-Jew when it comes to Tselem L'Kim. The only difference comes when it comes to who's Barim L'Mokom. That we are banim lamakom, and the rest of the world is not. Chaviv Yisrael, shnei banim lamakom, and again, Chaviv Yisrael, Hashem gave us kli chemda, shabaniv ha'olam, the Hashem gave us the Torah. So the Mishnah, is Rekiva's definition, is telling us, Nivra B'Tselem is universal. All mankind is Nivra B'Tselem. But as far as Yisrael's uniqueness, that's in the being the considered banim lamakom and receiving the Torah. That's what makes Klai Yisrael different from everyone else. But as far as Nivra B'Tselem, there's no difference. So on this Mishnah right here, again, in the commentary to Pirkei Avos Simcha Mevad Yosef Simcha Mevracha, he already makes this point, that it would seem clear from the Mishnah that this applies to B'nai Noach the same way it applies to Klai Yisrael. And there's no differentiation. He also quotes that the Tosfos Yontif brings that others wanted to say that it's not like that. And he disagreed. Says, as you see from the Mishnah, the Mishnah is a very clear indication that non-Jews and Jews alike are created b'tzelem l'kim. Now, this would mean that bechira applies to non-Jews the same way it applies to Jews. And I don't even know why that's so difficult, because, or why people have a problem with it, in that we know there's chav anish for goyim too. Goyim also receive reward and get punished. They have Zayin Mitzvahs. If they keep the Zayin Mitzvahs, they get Olam Haba. Olam Haba exists for non-Jews who keep the Zayin Mitzvahs. Those who accept it, who understand this from Hashem, there's requirements. Rabbi says not that they do it because they think it's a nice thing to do. If a non-Jew does the Zayin Mitzvahs because in his mind these are good things to do, that doesn't get him Olam Haba. But if he does it because Hashem said, and this is what the Torah says, and this is what my responsibilities are, then he also gets Olam Haba. And if he doesn't keep the Zayin Mitzvahs, then he won't. So, logically speaking, I don't know why we hesitate to or question the idea that there should be Tselem L'Kim. Now, again, there were Svarim that did make this distinction and wanted to say that there is no Tselem L'Kim by non-Jews. Well, the way you're suggesting, maybe a different Tselem L'Kim. But I'm not sure why we have to go there. I just don't know what's forcing that. I know that in the world of Hashgacha Pratis, there may be distinctions. In the world of Hashgacha Pratis, we may differentiate between Jew and non-Jew. But that doesn't mean there has to be a difference in Bechira. As Bechira is a human characteristic, the Baruch Hu made human beings with Bechira. And I think it's fair to say that that should apply to all human beings. All human beings have Bechira. And how we use a Bechira will determine how we'll be judged based on our choices we make. Okay, good choices, maybe not good choices. In the world of Hashgacha Pratis, in the Rebbeinu Shlom's guiding the universe, so there I can better appreciate or in my mind make sense of a different concept of Hashgacha for non-Jew versus Jew. Because we know there's different levels of Hashgacha anyway. There's Hashgacha Klodesh, Hashgacha Protis, or there's different language, Rebbeinu Mamchal uses it, of Mazel, and you know, there's different ways we look at it, but often we talk about Hashgacha Klodesh, Hashgacha Proti. So it could be with non-Jews, the Hashgacha is in a different type of Hashgacha. It's not the kind of watching and guiding that we have. The Gemara says, "Ein adam nokif etzpo malmatam ki goes malmala." The person doesn't bang his finger. You don't knock your knee into the leg of a table and go, ouch! Unless it's minas shamayim. Things like that are all decreed shamayim. Nothing happens. You don't bang your finger, stub your toe, knock your knee, hit your elbow, your funny bone. All these things, it's all minas shamayim. I don't know if that concept applies to non-Jews. I don't know. That may not apply to non-Jews. That degree of hashgacha, that every little thing is being decreed in heaven, maybe it's not. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's they're subject to a broader hashgacha klali as opposed to such a specific hashgacha prati. But that has nothing to do with bechira. That doesn't mean they can't have bechira. They can have Bechira, just it doesn't, you know, bring with it this idea. That's the thing where it makes more sense to me to differentiate between Jew and non-Jew in the term HaKadosh Baruch Hu Kachah Providence, divine providence. But in Bechira, I don't see anything compelling to force the statement that it's not there. I was like, what is the point in saying that? I'm not sure why there shouldn't be. But certainly, animals do not have Bechira Chavshus. There's no concept of Bechira by animals. Animals are not making decisions. They're not making choices. They are responding to stimulus. Animals will respond to stimulus, but they're not choosing to do anything. There's no thought process. The same thing teaching and training animals and dolphins and all that kind of stuff. They're not making choices. They're responding to stimuli, and there's a limit to where it's going to go to the next level. It won't go to the next level. So that's the uniqueness of man, and I think it would apply to all mankind. Again, when it comes to hashgachas, then there's room perhaps to question to what degree is the hashgacha. I know the Teferes Yisrael on the Mishnah goes on to say that not only do we say that non-Jews, all b'nei noyach, are niver b'tzelem alakim like Adam, but we have to appreciate the chassidim u'masoilim. We have to appreciate the great, pious people that came from the Gentile world. And when we think of chassidim u'masoilim, we usually think about people who saved Jews, the righteous Gentiles, the in the Yad Vashem, a list of all the non-Jews who saved Jewish lives during the Holocaust. And when you look in the Rambam, Hilchos Malachim, he writes the Chassidim Masa'olim are those who keep the Zayin Mitzvah Ben Noach. If a Ben Noach keeps the Zayin Mitzvah the way he's supposed to, that's Chassidim Masa'olim. The Rambam doesn't mention anything about saving Jews. Again, I asked Mir Shizim Avoch about it. He says, well, that's for sure. There's no question when a non-Jew saves Jews, he's Chassidim Masa'olim, and he'll get Olam Haba. The Chiddush is that even if, down on his own, he could do it without. He could live in a place where there are no Jews and no Shekhas to Jews, but he keeps the Zayin Mitzvahs because the Ibn Shalom gave a Torah, and this is their responsibility. He'll also be Chassidim Masa'olim, and he'll also get a Chiyat Gamba. But what the Teferes Yisrael does in the Mishnah is something a little radical. And he says, Chassidim Masa'olim isn't just people who save Jews and people who keep Zayin Mitzvah. It's non-Jews who have contributed immeasurably to the world. Now, from his time frame, he's talking the 18th century. So who are the Chassidim Masa'olim that he's talking about? Sir Francis Drake, who brought the potato to Europe. Chassidim Masa'olim. How many people survive on the potato? I think this is before the Great Potato Famine. But there was no potatoes. Potatoes are not indigenous to Europe. He brought them over. And for many people, that's all they had to eat. That's what they lived on. And he, I guess, took care of a certain issue with feeding the people, that he came up with the potato. And Pharisee says, for that, it's a tremendous contribution to mankind to bring the potato to Europe. Another one on his list is Gutenberg for inventing the printing press. So you know what that is, to create a printing press? Until then, every sefer had to be handwritten. And now you could publish and print. It's an amazing thing. Chassidim Masa'olim. So he had a very broad definition of Chassidim Masa'olim. And of course, I'm sure he would include Pasteur and others who've really helped humanity through their creativity, through their mistakes, whatever it was that what they did, and they brought about things that changed. Probably Jonas Salk would be on there. Was he a Yid? Was Salk Jewish? He may be Jewish. I don't know. If he wasn't Jewish, he was not. Okay, we're not too. I was thinking things like that. People who came up with enormous things like that. So he puts them, anyone like that would be Chassid Umasail. I think the point that we have to take from it is ultimately we benefit, the world benefit, and we benefit, Jews benefit, we all benefit from these things. And that's something that you they're going to be credited for. Again, I'm not saying everyone agrees to Teres Yisrael's definition, but that's his. It was up to him. He says by him it's pashut, it's simple. These people have olam haba for these accomplishments, for what they've done to help humanity. When the printing press was invented, so all of a sudden, people had access to books and printed material, which until then was really very limited. I thought in the world at large, you had monks who would monasteries sit there and write. They would be the scribes. They were literate and they would write, but it wasn't widespread to have written material. And all of a sudden, you have this explosion of printed material and books are being printed and spread. And Reshiva commented that it's odd that it took a while for the first Gemaras to be printed. Like, you would think the Jews would be right on top of this invention, and the people of the book, we should have Gemaras printed and published and so on and so forth. And it didn't happen right away. And the way he explained it was, unlike the rest of the world, Jews were literate and had Talmud scrolls in their homes. They had handwritten Gemaras, handwritten Sfarim. So we didn't need the printing press as much as the rest of the world right away. Eventually we did. And today, the amount that's published, if you think for a minute of the amount of Jews there are in the world, and if you want to take it further to the firm Jews in the world, religious Jews, compared to all Jews, compared to all humanity, and then take a look at how much is being printed for the Torah world in the form of English or Hebrew Sfarim, compared to how much is being printed or published globally, it's so disproportionate, it's unbelievable, that there are Sfarim coming out all the time. And their English books come out all the time for a very tiny fragment of the population. It's very disproportionate how much from people are using the printing press, or the, in that case, no longer printing press, it's offset, or whatever it is, compared to the rest of the world. For a small fraction of the world, the amount that we generate and purchase and have in our homes is totally way out of line with the rest of the world. So, and it's an incredible thing about Klai Yisrael. It's very disproportionate, the amount of volumes that we'll have in our home compared to non-Jews, how many volumes of books they have in their home. It's very disproportionate. So why back then, when the printing press came out, wasn't there this rush to print Sfarim then? And that's what she was answering, because we were always people of the book. We had scrolls. We had the handwritten manuscripts. We had all these things. So it wasn't all of a sudden the dam opening up and the flowing, and all of a sudden we had it already. Eventually it had to be replaced. They decided to print. But immediately when it came out, it wasn't something that we took advantage of right away. At that point, it wasn't something we felt a need for the way the rest of the world were lacking printed material. But of course, in time, we have totally eclipsed the rest of the world. It's mind-boggling. If you think just in this one prat about the uniqueness of Klai Yisrael, about where we are in the world of printing and publishing of printed material. Okay, but this is all a digression. The point of Teres Yisrael is that the one who created that ability, the one who started the ball rolling, of course he could be a chassid of Yisraelim. That all the Sfarim we have today and all that is all because, and you've taken away the painstaking process of handwriting to have it printed and offset and everything else. So he also gives that Gutenberg, certainly in his mind, is among the Chassidim Yisraelim. So Chava Adam Niv B'Tzelem, in the simple reading of it, will certainly include non-Jews, and this is why we have the other Mishnayos. When you meet someone in the street, say good morning. It makes no difference if he's a Jew, he's not. He's Tzelem Elokim. They're all Tzelem Elokim. all human beings are tzal malachim, and all of them should be treated with derech eretz and politely, and you should be the first one to say good morning to them when you see them. This is something that's just like aleph bays. This is something simple. I see no reason to say differently than that. When it gets to what makes chayis all different, that's the rest of the Mishnah. Banim l'malkam, Torah, perhaps hashgacha pratis, those are different things. You know, again, in the bigger scheme, a parent will be more attentive to his child. They'll be attentive to strangers in the neighborhood. So that's where you see the difference in hashgacha. But in Tzal Malachim, there's nothing, to me, there's nothing compelling to say different. And again, in the Chassidim Mus'aylim, you'll have also, and whether it's because it keeps Ayim B'Sperin Nayach, whether they are caring and saving of Jewish lives, or even like the Tiferes Sol says, contributing to humanity in a way that benefits the world in a huge, tremendous fashion. He puts them all together in the Chassidim Mus'aylim.